Welcome, listeners, to a new episode of the CASE podcast, another conversation about software engineering. Today, I'm very happy to have Gustav Nilsson-Kotte as my guest. Hi, Gustav.
Hi, Stefan. Nice to be here.
Gustav is an architect at IKEA, but I guess I'll leave the introduction to himself. So, Gustav, why don't you tell our listeners a bit about who you are and what you do?
Sure, thanks. My name is Gustav Nilsson-Kotte. I live in southern Sweden, in Ystad, near Malmö. I have studied at Chalmers in Gothenburg, Master of Science, Computer Engineering. And in 2008, I started working with .NET and a lot of web. And it's essentially been my whole career, going back and forth between the back-end, front-end, doing a lot of web-related projects. I work as a consultant at Jayway, and I've been working with IKEA on the M2 initiative since the beginning of 2016.
Yeah. Okay. So the topic of today's conversation is micro frontends, or frontends for microservices. So obviously, we'll have to start talking about all the bad things that we want to get away from once we do microservices. So let's start that and talk a little bit about monoliths and the typical things that people want to address.
Yes. So I think there's a common pattern especially in enterprise, in the enterprise world, where you have this awareness of that you can't have your whole enterprise in one service. So of course that's why SOA exists, and even I think way before SOA existed, we split up the enterprise architecture in different services. But the front end has always been kind of not really been thought about as a service, so that has still been a monolith. And now with the microservices ID, which in my mind is really a retake on SOA with the good parts. People from various places in the world have started to see that we have the same problem with a front-end monolith that we have with a back-end monolith. And so everything from not being able to release autonomously, also a growing code size, lots of bugs happening, lots of risks. You have to plan more, and you get into this evil feedback cycle where things just take longer time. So with this micro frontend architecture, we try to break that up so that teams are allowed to deploy autonomously and don't have to wait for each other, basically. So it's basically continuous delivery for web frontends.
So if I understand you correctly, what you're suggesting is that each of the teams would be responsible for their own front end in this organizational model, right?
Yes, exactly. So how this is split is from a high level, or the default way of splitting is that you have these verticals, and I know. For the self-contained systems ID that I know that you are quite familiar with, Stefan. But just at a large enough enterprise company, you tend to get also splits in the horizontals, so that there's basically a network of services and it goes quite deep. So it really depends on the size and the context of the organization, but to not have this big piece of front end in front of everything, and to have some form of autonomous services or teams in the front end, that's the goal, I think. Then how many services do you have? I mean, you can basically have thinking of a back end for front end concept, where you have some kind of back end service, and then you have the front end that's presenting those things. But I mean, of course, the idea will be that the back end and front end are the same team and service up to a certain point, where it kind of doesn't make sense to have that anymore. So it's kind of more of an art, or it's not, there's no truth or like this is the way it's going to have to be. That in my mind. So again, the key part is the autonomous things, autonomous deployment of front end services.
So what's the breaking point? What's the threshold in your view? How many people do you need to have collaborating on a system for it to make sense to split it this way?
Well, I'm quite inspired by the Amazon team size of two pizza teams. And that's, if you're not familiar with it, it's two, I think, quite large American family style pizzas. So kind of 10, 12 people, something like that. It's the people aspect of the number of relations between people are growing with by n squared, I think. So at some point, the team gets less and less effective of for the team size. I think that 10, 12 people is okay. 15 is a bit of a long stretch, and the 20 it really starts to hurt. That's how I think of it. So if you then think about that the teams has this constraint in size, which I think is a good starting point, if you take into account Conway's law, which basically says that teams and services are isomorphic in some way, I think that teams should be allowed to have more than one service. But there's this relationship of essentially one-to-one between teams and services. And you can have maybe a few small services as well within the team. But that kind of puts a pressure on the architecture that if you want to have small autonomous teams, the architecture has to follow. You can't have a monolith with these two pizza teams. Or well, you could have, and that would be the inverse Conway maneuver of breaking up a monolith into smaller services.
So let me try to get back to the different options that you have here. Yeah. One would be that you could let's say you have 24 people collaborating on a larger system. That's not a typical at all. It's a typical, even somewhat small size for a large project, right? It might seem huge to some of our listeners who've only worked on teams with five people and all, but for many enterprise developers and large scale projects, this is not at all atypical. So if you have 24 people, you could split them into a, let's say a front end team with six people, and then split the remaining, 18 to two different backend service teams. Then you'd end up with three teams, and one team, the front-end team, would be responsible for maintaining a consistent, well-defined, nice front-end part, and the other two teams would be responsible for their services.
Yeah.
What you seem to be suggesting is instead split them into two teams of 12 and have each of them responsible for the front-end part as well as the back-end parts. Can you, if that's the case, can you elaborate a bit on why you think that's a better model?
Yeah, sure. I tend to have this three tier architecture in my mind always when I think about this problem. If you have any kind of, but let's go back to your model. So the problem for the backend teams will be that if they have a story that they implement and are ready to deploy, the value will not be delivered for the end user unless there's a change in the front end as well. And since we have two service teams with a one front end, you will have increasing queue of front-end stories to expose the thing that the back-end teams are working on in order to deliver customer value in the end. And this is the same for how many layers you have. And this gives a kind of bad effect that from a high level perspective, you see that, okay, so you have a capacity problem in the front end team. So you have to add more people then. And adding more people, adding more code, you're just growing the monolith. You also need, and then you need more planning. You need more middle managers and need more control testing. So you had, again, this bad feedback cycle. So if this is a scenario that you see is happening, or that you can kind of simulate that, if we do like this, what will happen then? I think that would be a better way to split. It would be better to split the front end into two different services, where the back end services are have the competence and of front end and being able to deploy the front end themselves. Mm-hmm. Of course, this brings a whole another set of problems, of course, of collaboration and reuse of components, which is kind of the starting point of the microservice or micro frontends. Splitting services is really not hard. It's kind of recombining them that is the actual problem, and where I see that there's a few options that kind of turns your front end into something that you don't want in different kinds of ways.
So let me maybe tie this back to Conway's Law. Now, a really hard problem for this particular episode is that I have so many opinions on what you're saying, and I mostly agree with what you're saying. So I'm trying to, turn it a little down and just ask the kinds of questions that I think people will ask. So let me see. If you phrase it this way, it seems to make sense. I guess, or it will probably make sense to most people, that it is useful for a team to be able to deliver all of its story, not just parts of a story, and then have to sync with another team, have a meeting, and schedule something. So that's one part. But the second part of the reference to Conway's Law that you made was that there needs to be some architectural overlap for that to work nicely. So let me try to get to that point. Let's just assume I have what many people would call a typical modern web application, let's say a single page app built with a popular JavaScript framework of some sorts. Then the two teams could collaborate on a single application, on a single front-end monolithic application, without having a separate team that's responsible for this thing, right? You could have like 4 front-end developers in team A and 4 front-end developers in team B, and they all synchronize and deliver whatever the component model or module model of your JavaScript framework of choice is to the single application. Is that a good choice? And if it's not a good choice, what are the downsides?
Yeah, I think that will be the typical way, I think, to approach this. And I quite active on Twitter and searching on micro frontends and different keywords, and I tend to see that I think I need to back up here a bit, because so for me microservices is really about a diverse and heterogeneous architecture that it allows to have different technologies, as long as they follow the same kind of interface. The typical thing now seems to be that, oh, we can solve this micro frontend thing with a single library or framework, be that React or Angular, and just combine. We have a frame, and then we combine the components from the different teams in some kind of build system, which would be what was I saw a couple of years ago. But now we kind of tend to be more dynamic loading, which is good because you don't get the release trains and synchronization between teams. But still, there's this core problem that if you And it with more and more teams, it kind of becomes obvious with a small set of teams. So I think this 24 people example is kind of, it's really a good example, because is it worth it to support many different frameworks or libraries, or could you just go with one? I tend to think that we undervalue the we think it's easier than it is to replace the front-end framework. So I've seen this a couple of times where you have this large rewrite project of the front-end, and it's like, that's typical. Of course, you have to rewrite or do something with your enterprise software sometimes, but to have like 2, 3, 4 year cycle of rewrites is really not good for the business, and it would be better than to have support for a diverse technology stack in the front end from the start. I think one of the core problems is that the front end landscape is still changing a lot. We see that React is quite stable. Many teams like it. But Vue.js is coming faster and faster, and more growth. And so for long term use, and here is where I think maybe the startup world separates from the enterprise world, that maybe it's worth it for startups for some reason to go with a monolith or a single library. But if you have if you're, for example, a bank or e-commerce or what have you, and you will be in business for the next 10 years, and you don't want to rewrite your homepage like 2 or 3 times during that period of time, I think you want to have support for a diverse set of technologies, which kind of brings us back to, if you can't really rely on having a single framework, for example, React as a component library, having the alternative to write everything in vanilla.js is just writing your own framework or library, so which is a trap. So instead, I think having some form of transclusion mechanism is, as far as I know, and I haven't found anything else in the world that supports this, what we want. So, but transclusion is the only thing I have found to be this mechanism of loosely coupled micro frontends.
Okay, so we'll obviously get into that in a lot more detail.
Yeah.
Just to make it clear, so we're not talking about micro frontends as components within a single application that are somehow modular. We're talking about different ways. We're sort of talking about ways to achieve the kind of modularity and independence and autonomy that people expect from back-end microservices in the front-end part as well. Is that a fair way to phrase it?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
Okay. So you mentioned the term transclusion. Can you briefly explain what that is?
Yeah, sure. It's a bit confusing term because I think it's basically inclusion, but on the web. So there's a Wikipedia article for transclusion. There's the best example I know, if you haven't heard of transclusion any time before, is that you use it every time you browse the web, for example, with images. So you have a reference, an image tag, in an HTML document, and that image tag has a source attribute which points to your URL, and the browser will fetch the resource of that URL and replace the image tag during rendering with the image. So it will transclude the HTML document with the image document, making the image part of the HTML document, basically. So this will be client-side transclusion. I think iframes are also a good example of that. What is not very well known is that you can also transclude on the server side, which is and one of those technologies that can transclude on the server side is edge side includes, but also server side includes in the old, old way of building web.
Okay, so what is edge side includes?
So yeah, the edge part in edge side includes is for me the last layer where you have some form of control in your application or infrastructure. So typically on the internet you have a lot of proxies and stuff between the client and server. But if, for example, if you use a CDN, that could be the edge for you, or you maybe have some caching layer on, as the last layer of your architecture.
What's a CDN?
Content Delivery Network. So for example, you have Akamai, Fastly. And those actually do have ESI support. I can't really remember. There's a lot of CDNs. Yeah, I think you can Google it. So it's typically a thing that people have used to store resources to cache images and scripts and CSS. But you can also use it for site acceleration, so that, for example, instead of having It's a bit of a cloud thing, I would say now, that instead of having to go into an origin server directly, maybe you're in Germany, I'm in Sweden, you can, and if the content is cacheable, you can actually go to, your request can go to a server which has the request cached, and you can get a much faster response time. From the CDN. And the CDN can also do a bit of more interesting things, for example, edge side includes, if that's supported in CDN.
Okay.
So the edge side includes tag, I think it's quite old. I can't really remember, but I think it's like 15 years old or so, more than that. I think it's 1999. So edge side includes was based, I think, from within Akamai, and there's a name that constantly pops up there. That's Mark Nottingham. I think he lives in Australia. He was the editor for the edge side includes standard proposal, and there's more companies. I think Oracle was one of them, trying to have an way to include documents on the server side, so to do transclusion. And ESI is basically like the image tag, but for HTML and on the server side. So you have a source attribute and the URL will indicate that someone needs to fetch that URL from that origin and include a result in the resulting document. It's as simple as that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what's a good use case for that? Do you have use cases for that in your system?
Yes, I would say that it's a fundamental technology in the IKEA from microfrontends concept. That's really core part of that. So what we are doing is that we have this notion of pages and fragments, and that's basically the ESI lingo, I guess. So a team could have responsibility for a set of pages and or fragments, and fragments is those are HTML documents that are not complete. They don't have a body tag, for example. They're just basically a div or something that's not complete. And pages can then have ESI references to fragments, and those references can then cross the team boundaries. So you can, for example, if you have a product page, that page can refer to the header and footer fragment, which makes the menu header footer reusable, so that the product team doesn't have to reinvent the wheel. And the same goes in the other direction, that maybe the product team has some fragments for product thumbnails. Now I'm in the e-commerce domain, basically. So which makes other teams makes it possible for other teams to not reinvent the wheel and so they can refer to product thumbnails from the product team, for example. So there's a reuse between team boundaries, over team boundaries, and that's what I said before, that it's easy to split up something, but it's hard to glue the parts together again. And ESI is the core technology that we have that we have found to be really useful for our services.
So one of the things that I find interesting about ESI as opposed to SSI, server side includes, which many listeners will know, I guess, is that ESI has its origins in the caching world. You actually exploit that? Do you use the fact that ESI supports caching?
I think I'm not 100% clear on what you mean, but we do cache ESI. The resulting ESI document, ESI process document, for 15 minutes, and we also cache the requests. That's maybe what you refer to, so that we can. There's only a fraction of the page that has actually changed, so we can reuse the cache in the edge layer then.
Actually, I was wondering, in the way you explained things just now, separating a page into its parts, its fragments, it seems that some parts of the page are quite are a lot more static than other parts of the page.
Yes.
So, what's the relation of static versus dynamic aspects of different pages?
Yeah, that's a good question. I would say that there's for sure different caching profiles, and in our example or in our project, and I guess and in all web pages have this property of some parts move less. Much slowly than other parts. For example, the header footer is much less updated than maybe price information or what have you. So those things are typically nice to cache. And if one thing has changed, it doesn't make sense to go to the origin for the rest of the components in the page. So that's what you. So instead of having the page as one monolith, that if anything has changed on that page, you have to invalidate the whole page and go to fetch everything. You can just replay, and that's happening as automatically with the caching and the shared includes, that it will just fetch the things that have actually gone out of cache for various reasons. And that's a really, really nice property. That being said, there's a distinction that if you cache the results of an ESI processing, you can't really have dynamic or personalized responses, because I think of caching as a way of reusing requests between different people has requested. So if you have requested a page and you cache it in the, and there's a caching mechanism in the CDN, then I can also reuse it if we are closely located. But if that's your user profile page, you really don't want that to be cached, right? So, and that's the also a caching profile thing, that some things should really not be cached for obvious reasons. And so there's a, I think that's a good variable to look for different different caching profiles. So and just what I've, my conclusion from the last years here is that things that you can cache typically can be quite heavily cached if you can invalidate the cache with some kind of cache purge mechanism to push a cache invalidation to the edge. And then you have some personalized views, for example, the user profile, that maybe even could work out well as a single page application, because you have a lot of state and you don't want to keep that state on the server side, because it's kind of clunky. So I think that's maybe a bit of a difference where between you and I, Stefan, that maybe I am a bit more friendly to single page applications, to be honest, as long as you have a foundation that has kind of a server side lingo or concept base.
Okay. So, for example, your product pages, I seem to recall that products are something that you can actually pre-generate. Do I remember that correctly?
Yeah, exactly. So that's another nice relation with being able to cache something quite heavily. So just to be clear here, we're caching the results of an ESI processing for 15 minutes, but the underlying documents are cached for 4 to 8 hours. Right now, which is quite long. But then we have the ability to invalidate the cache when we change things, and that kind of historically, like we didn't start here, but you can start anywhere. We started with generating static pages. So what we started to build was basically a static file generator, static site generator, which is nice for cache invalidation, because when you know that something has happened, you upload a file and then you purge the cache. So things that doesn't change is not invalidated, and they just live on and have a long cache time. And if you know that the document has changed, you upload it and you purge the cache. So you have basically the browser cache is also 15 minutes. So you basically have a 15-minute time to live for things that have changed and not been updated yet. So at the IKEA M2 project, we have there's a lot of products, of course, at IKEA and different markets. But right now, I think we are uploading between 3 and 4 million files that we have in scope, which is a lot, but we don't update them regularly. I mean, yeah, it depends on if they change and if we change a template or what have you. But it's it's a nice. I really like the static site generator architecture for things that support caching, and that.
Okay.
And then I kind of really like the single page application architecture for things that are personalized and that have more client side near state. And be able to have these two very different kinds of web architectures, and also of course to be able to do some rendering maybe in a legacy Java server pages application, to have the ability to have these three and more really diverse ways of doing web I think it's what not proves, but shows that this micro frontend thing is really valuable, because you're able to lift services from maybe a legacy applications to something new, and still have the same web architecture overall, how you actually integrate between the different web architectures, you might say.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the good evolvability part of this microservice web architecture, right, which wouldn't be possible if you have if you lock into a single base of a single JavaScript library or what have you, or server side for that sake.
Right. So I think I don't think we actually disagree, right? So just for the record, I don't like single page applications if they're really single. Right? If there's just one single application for a large system, then I typically think that's a problem. If it's multiple, then it's perfectly fine. I think that none of these things, none of the things we're talking about, not microservices, not micro frontends, not ESI, not any of the other stuff we're going to talk about, is the right choice in every situation. Right? It all depends. Just every time somebody says this is the only thing you can ever use or implies it, then that's the point where I get sort of nervous, because like you, I think there's value in different aspects.
Yeah.
So maybe let's get back to one of the, I think, kind of interesting questions here. So the way you explained it, I understand that different teams would own fragments and pages. And then a page might be assembled from stuff that has been produced by different teams at runtime, which of course means that these things need to fit together somehow. Mm-hmm. How do you ensure that this actually works? Because knowing that a web page is a complicated thing, you'll have not only the HTML, but also the CSS and the JavaScript and all the things a fragment or a page relies on. How do you make sure that all of these things fit together?
Yeah, a very good question. So up until now, in this discussion, we have the HTML in the page between different teams. So what you're saying is, but there's more than HTML in a page. There's CSS and JavaScript. So how do you go about that and reusing that? So,
well, not only that. That's okay. One part of the question. I think it's the connection between those things. Let's say, for example, that I produce a piece of HTML that relies on a certain JavaScript library to be available, or that relies on Bootstrap style CSS grid framework to be used. Then I make assumptions. My HTML does not stand on its own. It relies on an environment that may or may not be there. That's sort of that's strongly related to what you're referring to. I think it's the connection between those things.
Yeah. So basically, as a fragment producer, what can I assume of the underlying or the surrounding environment where I'm going to be included?
Exactly.
And that's it comes down to what do we think is a good common base for pages and fragments, and if we say that we have to go back and say if there's a difference between pages and teams, you can't, as a fragment producer, you can't really use it has to be the same. Because you can't really control who's using your fragments. So if some team is using React, you could of course cheat a little bit and use React in your fragments. But then if another team wants your fragments and they don't use React, maybe they don't use anything at all, or they have an Angular app, would you force them to use React as well? So there's kind of becomes a virus that suddenly everyone needs to have everything. This is the extreme argument, of course. But especially, I think on the front page, the landing page of a the top domain, it tends to be that many teams want to have be on the first page, and that page is the most sensitive part of the website for performance. And there you really don't want to have lots of libraries. So instead, we need to shift and take the opposite approach, saying that we can have a really, really small and slim base of maybe a CSS set and a small amount of typography, basically things that never change or change very, very seldomly, and also are versionless. Maybe some polyfills would be nice here as well. These have to be agreed upon, but it shouldn't really be hard to form this agreement. And then as a fragment, then this is one approach. As a fragment, then you have to be self-contained. So everything that you need has to be included in some way so that you have the things that you need, CSS and JavaScript, what have you. The other approach is to, which is a kind of, I don't think it might scale for some scenarios and might not for others. And I guess this really depends. But having a style guide or style library could be a solution for in some contexts. And for us right now, we don't think it's a good idea. Maybe in the future. So then we have this notion of self-contained fragments, where if you want to use, for example, the header footer, and you need CSS for that, you have to include another ESI fragment or HTML fragment with ESI that contains the link rel tag for that fragment. And it's kind of a, if you think in Java, if you want to use, if you want to make an instance of an object, you have to do an import to get the type and class in order to do this, to create an instance. This is kind of the same thing, that in order to use a fragment instance, you have to import the fragments for its type, style, and script fragments. And the reason why we want to do for fragments and not having a hard reference to JavaScript files or CSS files is that we use, and I think it's a good practice that to use cache busting in the file names of static resources so that you can cache them for basically a year or longer. And then you don't want these references to leak, these names to leak into the consumers.
So therefore, I think you'll have to explain cache busting.
Okay, yeah, thanks. So let's say that you have a CSS file, main.css. If you, and also that you will let to be cached, you might make a thought experiment, say, well, I want this to be cached for 1 year. And then after a few days, maybe after releasing this, you realize that, maybe it was not a very good idea to have a one-year-long browser cache because I want to make an update now, and now I have to change the name to main2.css, and that will work. So all forms of caching has a cache key, which is often the file name or URL. And instead of having this ad hoc process of adding a suffix to a version number to a file that you want to cache, we can add a more, you can have a date time, or as in our case, we use an MD, some form of hash. Doesn't really matter which kind of hash, but a content hash, so that we have a part in the file name that reflects the content of the file. So when we change the file, we get a new file name. And then, of course, all the references to that file has to change as well. which is a good reason to have the number of references to that file very, very small.
Okay. So the ESI tag would remain, the ESI include that you make would be the same, but it would be replaced by the actual reference to the write file.
Yeah, the ESI reference is versionless, but mm-hmm. the fragment contains a reference to a file that is versioned, which is controlled by the producing team of that fragment or CSS file. Mm-hmm. So that you keep.
Okay, so instead of updating the version in place, you replace it with a link to the new file. So things become immutable and thus cacheable forever.
Yeah. So in our case, it would be like emailing all the teams that has this would have this resource, and you wouldn't even have the email. You can't really know who's referring to that file unless you do some kind of analysis on what's actually on the web. So instead, it's better to have a decoupled strategy of using fragments as the way to export and import related resources for fragment types.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so yeah,
it's a bit complicated, but in the end, it becomes really simple because you don't really have to think about the dependencies for a fragment. You just include one ESI in the top for styles and one ESI in the bottom for scripts, and then you're done. So mm-hmm. it actually becomes very simple. But underlying, of course, there's a reasoning there. Why this is needed?
So do you have some sort of contract between the fragment and the surrounding page in terms of the markup that it's allowed to use? I mean, we now talked about the styles and the JavaScript it's allowed to reference, but are there rules for whether it can include a table or a div or whatever?
We don't really have that many rules for fragments that I on the top from the top of my head see here. So we try to. So this is a kind of a general approach that I like as well. So it's better to not be super smart and think very very intense of everything that can go wrong. It's better to when things go wrong. When things go wrong, to try to fix the errors and try to learn from that. Mm-hmm. So basically, favoring mean time to recovery mean time between failures. So, and things have gone very very smoothly with these fragments. Maybe we are just lucky, but we don't have that many rules for how for what you can include. Mm-hmm. What we do have is that you can't include. So fragments are self-contained, but that doesn't mean that you can include a whole JavaScript library for that fragment type. And that's maybe a hard rule that we have, because if you have different fragment types from different teams and all they have different dependencies, you will end up with multiple libraries for some pages, which would break the performance budget for that page or really make the performance less for end users, which is something that we don't want. That would be a hard rule, not including that much for fragments.
But now I'm curious, what's a performance budget?
All right, so this is measuring performance in the first place is I think kind of hard. Performance budget would be for me the number of kilobytes or megabytes that you should be allowed to have as a web page, and that is because the size the time it takes to download these assets takes time for the end user, which is hurting performance, and also in the case of JavaScript, I think there's for a mid-range smartphone, you get 1 second parsing time for 1 megabyte of JavaScript. So this, in the end, what you want is, of course, as good performance as possible for all your end users. But they also have different networks, different CPUs. So it's not really, it's hard to measure, and it basically becomes a long tail of performance profiles. So performance budget is a proxy measurement for having something that's easily measured, basically.
Interesting. It reminds me, I think it's in Don Reinertsen's product, development book, where he mentions that at an airplane company, every team had a budget in terms of weight, and they were measured by whether they were able to reduce the weight that they contributed to the overall plane was supposed to be as little as possible, because that influences everything. So kind of the same thing, because the weight of every fragment will influence the weight of the whole page, which will influence the happiness of the actual end user sitting in front of that thing. Interesting.
That book is really good, and that example is great. I think that just from what I think right now, it's easy for developers or teams to take local decisions, which makes sense for them, but can really hurt the system as a whole, or the page performance as a whole. So that's why there needs to be some kind of rules in place where there's no, we have no budget for fragments, but just saying they should be fairly small. And then learn from that.
Okay, so you would advise against implementing a little shopping cart icon with Angular, something like that.
Yes, because that shopping cart icon would be in the header footer, which is included by all pages and teams, which will mean that all teams would have a dependency on Angular, which would mean that no team could use anything else than Angular, which would break the property of microservices, where you have support for diverse and heterogeneous architectures.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. Very good. So we've talked about ways to do transclusion on the server side using ESI, and many of the same things could be said for SSI as well, or for other concepts that do maybe homegrown things that do the same thing on the server side. What about the client side?
Yeah, that's a nice... For me, I see ESI as a base for doing micro front ends. And the problem is, of course, that you might not want to load the full page, for example, below the fold. And now I guess I should explain what below the fold is.
Yes,
so
please.
So there's of course a lot of different screen sizes, but at some point you will say, okay, so here is the part of the page which basically no end user will see, and there you can do a bit of tricks to, for example, laser load, so that you don't load that part of the page until the user has scrolled to a close enough part of the page, and you start loading the components and fragments for that part of the page. I'm not really talking about like infinite scroll solutions, but more saying that it doesn't make sense to load something that's not visible by a lot of people. Would be better if for the end user not having bandwidth for that because they didn't use it, and it didn't bring value for the company organization because nobody really saw it. And it's also, I guess, better for the environment because you shift, you're sending bytes that is not really used. Then of course you can make the argument why have it in the first place, but maybe it's scrolled for 5 or 10% of the user. So having client side includes for lace loading would be a nice use case. There's also the scenario, for example, if you have a typical search application that could be written in a single page application framework. So you have a search box where you type things, and the end users more and more expects to get results directly when they type, and to get search results. At that time, ESI is no longer an option because you are only on the client side, which means that you have to load fragments on the client side then instead of the server side. So in our case, it would mean that you will have an ESI ESI references to the styles and script fragments, but then load the content fragments, the instances, using the client side. Then there's different, and that's really, really, really simple. Because you basically have, for example, in a search result, you get a list of maybe product IDs. You transform them to a list of URLs where these fragments are for these products, and then you make AJAX or fetch requests for them, and include them in some form of container. But there's also a bit more declarative approach to using client-side includes, which there are a few libraries on the web that has a more declarative way of client-side includes. Again, Mark Nottingham, one of the persons behind the Edgeside Includes from Akamai, I found a small library by him called Edge Include, which has support for doing a more declarative way of including. That was kind of 10 years old when I found it, so I wanted to make a port for custom elements in the web component standards thing. That, I think, is quite an improvement to the original version, because you can just add a DOM element to with JavaScript, for example, in the search example, and it will make it include. So it's kind of flexible, and also for the lazy loading example, it's much easier for the application to stop generating ESI include tags below a certain point and start rendering H include tags.
H include then is a custom tag, or can you explain a little bit more? How would a web developer what would they have to produce, and who would take care of transforming that into the actual intended result?
H-include is a custom element so if you import the library, it will register the H-include tag as a valid HTML element type. So, and then the browser has some hooks where you get events when the tag is or tag element is created and inserted in the DOM, and when attributes are updated and when it's removed from the DOM and the garbage collected, something like that. So I really like the idea of custom elements. Seemed like version 0, that was, I think, mostly developed by Google, didn't really catch on. And version 1 of custom elements seems to catch on, but there seemed to be some kind of weird dependency with ECMAScript 2015, not really easy polyfill. So I think for the HT include example, I think that version zero is still a good way to use it. There's a very, very small polyfill written by.
I think you've used the term two or three times now. Can you explain what a polyfill is?
Yes, sure. A polyfill is a JavaScript library. I don't know if you can do that with CSS as well, but it's taking it's basically lifting older browsers to current standards by when it's possible to, for example, if you don't have a map function on an array in JavaScript, you could theory polyfill that to make those arrays have a map function, so that you, for example, in IE 7 that doesn't have a map function, it suddenly has that if you import a polyfill. So there's a detection mechanism that sometimes you have to implement yourself by feature detection, and then load the polyfill library to lift older browsers.
Mm-hmm. So in your example, the h-include custom element would require the browser to support custom elements, and if the browser didn't support them, then the polyfill would add that support.
Yes, okay. And that's not included in h-include, so you have to do that for yourself.
Okay. Okay, so essentially it seems very similar to the ESI thing in that it's declarative. You just render HTML that says what you want there. The only difference is that it's replaced on the client as opposed to the server side. Well, exactly. It's a very big difference, but not for the developer rendering that HTML.
Yes, exactly. There's an interesting difference here, though. That is also one of the reasons why we went with fragment imports and exports for styles and scripts. And that's it. That is, if you include a fragment with HTML on the client side, which contains scripts, references to scripts and CSS, the browser will not include or load those resources in the browser, because I guess it's a security risk. So you have to do something else with that, and basically it becomes really, really complex to be able to handle that kind of scripts in responses on the client side. It's not impossible, but it's much, much simpler to have the default standard browser behavior when loading scripts and CSS. Which is, again, one of the reasons why we want to separate content from the resources.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Also, that being said, it's I know that there's a nice microfront and a library called Taylor by Zalando that is kind of doing this. I think they're using link rels in the header HTTP headers, and they are have support for loading things client side. But they seem to be really smart people, so good. That's another way to do micro frontends using the Taylor library.
Mm-hmm.
Haven't really looked that much into it, but it seems to be nice.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So for those of our listeners who understand German, there's a podcast with a colleague of mine in German on our company podcast, InnoQ podcast, that actually talks about Taylor a bit as well. And we might link to that as well. Of course, to the Zalando site and the framework itself as well. I think it's quite similar in terms of the fact that it supports both server-side and client-side transclusion. It's slightly different tags, different technologies, but the overall effect is sort of similar in that it allows for composition of front ends developed by different teams. Okay. So one of the things that that comes up occasionally is that if you do things the wrong way, then you might hurt yourself in terms of search engine optimization. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah. That's, in general speaking, for any site, but especially for an e-commerce site, search engines or search engine traffic is really, really important. And it depends on who you ask, but the question of can Google really index pages that are rendered with JavaScript, it depends on who you ask, even internally on Google. But what I've seen just the latest couple of weeks is that the answer from Google is that we might do that or we might not do that, depending on if they have computing resources for the search bot in place. So that kind of tells us that you can't really be sure if it will render JavaScript or not. And since client-side includes is based on JavaScript and Ajax, this leads us to think that you shouldn't really have client-side includes for search engine sensitive content. This also relates to this large, say, single page application alternative architecture where you will have like one based on one library and render everything client side. And then if you find yourself that you suddenly have a search engine optimization requirement on you because your e-commerce actually is completely rendered in JavaScript, I think that you are in a very, very complicated state in there. Pre-rendering, also being able to server-side render and then doing some client-side rendering after that, coming down to the isomorphic or your universal web apps. I think that teams that are able to pull that off seem to have a lot of good engineers in those teams. But I will say that I'd rather spend those engineering cycles or effort on something that actually solves business problems and not accidental complexity, basically, as I see it. So, which is another, I think, reason to start thinking of having server-side rendering or static site generation as a kind of base architecture, and then for cases when you have a high amount of personalization or what have you, do more client-side, because that's not sensitive for search engines anyway.
Okay. So is that the full range of options that we now talked about, where you consider doing things on the server side, on the client side, possibly adding a single page out where it makes sense, taking search engine optimization into account? Is that the full range of technologies and architectural choices that you see for teams who want to go about building micro frontends? It's fine if it is. I'm just wondering, did we miss anything, or do you use anything else?
Yeah, let me think a little bit about this. I think one interesting thought here for micro frontends is the case that some organizations seem to have, that they have a lot of client-side interactions on their pages, and that you maybe have 3, 4, 5, 6 teams on the same page, where you basically have an application. I always think like Photoshop on the web or what have you, that different teams can make different panels or components. Which is really not the thing that I have worked on. So I don't really have an experience in that kind of setting. But I guess that having this ESI include as a base will still make sense, because then it will decouple the components from the teams from their respective versions. But so maybe, and this is really a big maybe micro frontends makes less sense if you have a really, really complicated UI. Maybe you have a specialization there instead of the, and maybe time to market is not that valuable mm-hmm. in that kind of setting. So this brings us back to the universal answer of, is this the right architecture for everyone? And of course it's not. So I think you have to go back and look at the organizational level, or what are the trade-offs. And that's always, you know, that you're in a good place where you have contradiction in your requirements. That, well, this is the pros of this approach, but there's also some cons, and we have to think a bit of what we need and the value mm-hmm. and the cost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Awesome, that's a great summary of the whole thing. Okay, so mm-hmm. what's a good place for people to start learning about micro frontends if they want to go into more details?
I wrote an article called Microservice Websites where I tried to collect my thoughts. We can link to mm-hmm. that. I've also did a little manifesto style website with basically a summary. And I try to keep that updated when I come up with when I find new ideas or learn things. I also have an our dev talk, which on YouTube, or their presentation, which has become recently quite popular on YouTube, actually. So that's fun. So we can link to that as well. Mm-hmm. There's also micro front end, let's see here. Frontends.org. No, there's another way, another initiative, I think, to collect these related to micro frontends. Maybe we can collect a few more links after the discussion.
We can certainly do
that. Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Okay. Good. So I think we're at the end of our time slot. Gustav, it's been great talking to you. Thanks for all the insights. Thanks for taking the time.
And really nice to be here.
Yeah, great to have you. Thanks to our listeners for listening, and until next time. Bye.
Great. Bye-bye.